Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In the Sean Bell police shooting trial this week, an optometrist testified about Bell's eyesight as he drove his car that fatal night. And the judge heard the grand jury testimony of Detective Michael Oliver, who fired most of the 50 shots that killed Bell and wounded two of his friends on Bell's wedding day. And there was some key testimony by a friend of Bell's named Gene Nelson, at one time sought by police as a possible fourth man in Bell's car. WNYC's Arun Venugopal and Daily News reporter Nicole Bodie are back with us as they continue to cover the trial. Hi, Arun. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Brian.
Good morning, Brian.
Arun, the optometrist first. Who is he? What did he say?
Dr. Daniel Friedman is his name, and he saw Sean Bell several months prior to the night of the shooting. Bell came in for a checkup, and Friedman testified that Bell's right eye was just, he could barely see out of it, that his vision was so bad it was actually pretty much off the chart, that I think it was poorer than 20 over 400. So he was easily would fall into legal blindness in terms of his right eye. His left eye was better, not perfect vision, but it was better. The other thing he said is that he told Bell he could have it corrected with glasses or contact lenses, but that he never came back. So we're not really sure whether that night of the shooting, whether he was even wearing anything or not. The autopsy didn't really go into that particular detail as to whether he was wearing contacts. Some of his family members said yes, he did, but there was no glasses. It could play a role, but going in either way.
Going either way. Nicole, do you agree? Is this good for the prosecution, the defense, or is it ambiguous?
I think it's fair to say that this is a pretty, it could be read either way. If the prosecutors wanted to use this to their side of the case, they could say, well, Bell wouldn't have had any vision of Detective Isnora's badge as he stepped up to the car, which would be an asset to the prosecutors as they try to say that Detective Isnora didn't sufficiently identify himself when he approached these men. The defense could also claim that if Bell knew that his vision was this poor and took no measures to correct it, didn't wear any glasses, didn't wear any contact lenses, got behind the wheel of the car while he was drunk, which would have further impaired his vision, that it was partially his own responsibility that he couldn't see the officer identifying himself. So you could definitely see this both ways.
I guess then on the question of a manslaughter charge, an issue might be how effectively, at what standard, does an officer have to identify himself? Does he have to identify himself, to the standard that somebody who is legally blind in one eye and okay in the other eye would be able to notice him, or something less than that? Yes?
Yeah, I certainly think that that's going to be up for interpretation for this judge, Arthur Cooperman, but I think the sort of apparent standard for any of this is what a reasonable person would do under those circumstances. So, I think that's probably up for debate what defines reasonable. But I think, if an officer under any circumstances not knowing what a person on the other side of that windshield could or couldn't see took reasonable steps to identify themselves as a police officer, and it certainly remains up to the judge to decide whether or not Detective Isnora did that, that would seem to be, the definition that is at issue here.
Brian, part of the problem here is that as far as the defense might paint this particular issue of the vision and the alcohol and Bell's impairment that night, is that there's this question as to whether Bell was driving into Isnora on purpose, using his car as a weapon. But you have to, of course, see this through Isnora's eyes. Could he have construed what might have been just simply sloppy driving, somebody who was drunk, who couldn't see very well, as being threatening when it was actually not meant as threatening? So that, of course, also lends itself to, to the defense's arguments.
Right. Now let's go on to another witness, Sean Bell's friend, Gene Nelson, who testified on Tuesday. He was once sought as the so-called fourth man. Remind us, Arun, what was the fourth man theory?
Well, there was this theory that basically the fourth man might have had the gun that got away, that he was there, and that he sort of escaped and kind of complicated the defense's effort to really pin this on the members, the people who were in the car that night.
Because it's such a basic part of this case that after the shooting, it was discovered that none of the three who were shot were armed, right? So police had reason to hope, at least, that there was a fourth man or someone with a gun in that party, which would serve to help justify the shooting. So that's by way of background. And, Nicole, what did Gene Nelson add to the story?
Well, what's really remarkable is, given all of the publicity in the beginning of this case about this so-called fourth man, there was no mention of that on the stand when Gene Nelson took the stand. There was no questioning under cross-examination by the defense, no mention at all, which is pretty remarkable given how much of an issue it was to begin with. But when Mr. Nelson took the stand, he said that he saw Detective Isnora step up in front of Sean Bell's car with his gun pointed. He said that he heard Isnora say, "Let me holler at you," which is slang for "let me talk to you," which would seem to support the prosecution side that he didn't identify himself as an officer. But then Gene Nelson also said that Sean Bell floored his, you know, floored the engine and would have squashed Detective Isnora had he not jumped up over the hood and onto the sidewalk. So his testimony seemed to be very supportive of the defense's claims that Detective Isnora stepped in front of this car, he admitted he had his gun out, he claimed he had his badge clipped, and he claimed that he said, you know, that he addressed himself to these men. Obviously, you know, "let me holler at you" is a very significant difference than "police don't move." But he seemed to set up a series of events that would be supportive of the defense. The other thing that he mentioned that is new in this trial that we've never heard before is that he heard Sean Bell fighting with the supposed man in black, this SUV driver outside the club, and he claimed that this man in black threatened, "I'm going to shoot y'all back up. And then he claimed that a friend of Sean Bell's said, "I'm going to take that gun from you," and that Sean Bell reiterated, "Yeah, we'll take that from you," which is the first we've ever heard of someone affirming, other than a, you know, uniformed police officer, that there was talk of guns, that in addition to there being talk of guns, that Sean Bell himself had talk of guns. So, again, another thing that could potentially help the defense significantly.
Now, your colleague, Nicole, the Daily News columnist Dennis Hamill, found Nelson very credible and full of detail. He cited some of the same details that you just gave. Mm-hmm. Was that the general reception of Nelson in the courtroom?
Certainly it depends who you're asking. Mr. and Mrs. Bell, Sean Bell's parents, found Gene Nelson to be very uncredible. They called him a, quote, "yes man" for the defense. They said that it was the first that they had really heard of this guy being, you know, a friend of their son's. They said he was no friend of his, didn't know Sean very well, and basically seemed to think that he was doing nothing to, you know, help the prosecution's case. They found him completely incredible. Obviously, the defense finds him to be so credible that at the end of the cross-examination by attorney Anthony Rico, who represents Detective Isnora, he said, "You're probably going to have a lot of trouble going back into the neighborhood after giving testimony like this." Obviously, you know, testimony that would go against the defense, the prosecutors. So really, you know, it was, you know, depending on the eye of the beholder, whether he's credible or not credible.
So, Arun, another defense witness, in effect, put on the stand by the prosecution. We've talked every week about how the prosecution seems to be putting it all out there, facts that are good for them, facts that are bad for them. How does Gene Nelson help them get convictions of the three detectives?
Well, I suppose that, you know, it's definitely a very mixed blessing, and sometimes it's, you know, you can sit there and you kind of wonder the same question, why exactly are they putting these people up? I kind of felt like the same thing with, to be honest, with the optometrist. But with Gene Nelson, I did think that he was credible. He had very specific observations about that night. At the same time, you know, the fact that he did say, you know, Isnora said, "Let me holler at you," I'm not so sure that really helps the defense, because it hardly, you know, gives a clear indication that he's identifying himself as a policeman. In fact, he said he didn't say anything about being a policeman, that he just basically walked up to him with a gun. so that's the kind of thing that, you know, Sean Bell and Joe Guzman inside the car could have perceived as, you know, sort of coming out of that incident they would just come out of, which is the man with the gun, the SUV guy in front of the club, very dangerous kind of situation they came out of. So I do actually think it's a mixed blessing, but in general, you know, we're not really sure. The logic of the prosecution has been generally, you know, put everything out there, and whether or not the defense is even going to mount arguments at this point is unclear.
Nicole?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair assessment. I think that certainly Gene Nelson is a central witness, but the only two witnesses whose testimony will presumably make or break this case is going to be the two men who survived that were inside that car, and that's going to be, you know, Trent Benefield and Joseph Guzman.
And so, they're expected to testify next week, aren't
they? That's correct. Yeah, they're supposed to take the stand Monday and Tuesday.
So no doubt we'll be talking about that next week. But Arun, when you said the defense may not even mount a case, you mean they may not call any witnesses when the prosecution is done?
I mean, that's what some people close to the case have suggested. The defense has been a little cagey about it. I think at this point the prosecution does not assume that they will be presenting anything. That, you know, for all we know, in a few days, this you know, argument could be over. It's possible. Or that we'll more likely have a very short presentation by the defense, and that it'll be left in the hands of Judge Cooperman.
And one more time, why would the prosecution present a case that would leave the defense with nobody to call to the stand?
Well, I certainly think that, you know, if the sort of general assessment of the prosecution's case so far has been fair, that a lot of the witnesses that have been called by the prosecutors have cut both ways for the prosecutors. It may be that they know that the judge was already privy to this information because he had access to all of the grand jury testimony from any witness that, you know, that he chose. Whether or not they felt it was appropriate to pick and choose which of the witnesses to recall in their side of the case, when this judge already knew pretty much the content of everyone's testimony, it remains, you know, remains unclear.
We just have a couple of minutes for today to talk about the Sean Bell police trial with Nicole Bodie covering it for the Daily News and WNYC's Arun Venugopal. And I want to get to one more, not witness exactly, but it was testimony by one of the defendants himself, read into the record at the trial. It was from Detective Michael Oliver, who fired 31 of the 50 shots, including several that hit Sean Bell. This was a reading from his testimony to the grand jury who indicted him. So what about Oliver's grand jury testimony was presented at the trial, Nicole?
Well, the most significant portion of his testimony is the series of descriptions of how he came to empty two full magazines in his weapon when there was no gunfire being returned from the inside of this car. And the content of this and how he got to the point where he felt so compelled that he had to fire 31 times at this car and the passengers inside of it was the most riveting portion of his testimony. It seems that Oliver felt so concerned about the welfare of Detective Isnora, who was standing in front of this car that Sean Bell and his friends were inside of, and yelling the word gun, which Detective Oliver heard him yell, that he needed to get out of his car and begin aiming and firing at the passenger, Joseph Guzman, in this, you know, inside of this car, emptied basically his entire magazine at Guzman, and then, in his own words, wasn't sure if his gun had either stopped firing, had jammed, had run out of bullets, so he immediately takes a clip out of his waist and puts it back in the gun and begins emptying it. His attention is drawn by the passenger in the back seat, Trent Benefield, and he begins aiming at him because he says he sees the window in the back shatter out. He's pressed on this by the grand jurors asking, why didn't you take cover rather than opening your weapon? Why didn't you stop after your first clip or anywhere after that to find out whether or not there was gunfire being returned from inside that car or anywhere else? And he said that he felt he was so concerned about the movement of Joe Guzman inside that car, reaching for what he presumed was a gun at his waistband, that he had to keep firing at him until he, in his own words, eliminated the threat.
So, Arun, one more time, why would the prosecution play this tape of the defendant himself making his case to the grand jury?
Well, I do think it plays into this larger pattern that we see of officers basically acting on without really even seeing any evidence that they're. I mean, none of these officers obviously saw a gun because there was no gun. The three officers who are on trial, Cooper, Isnora, and Oliver, seem to be sort of shooting into the night in a sense. They were basically firing into this car, assuming a lot of things that were clearly not true. It seemed to be really a scattershot sort of approach, a very improvised, last-second kind of a thing. And so it does kind of lend credibility to the prosecution's argument that they didn't really know what they're doing. They're just kind of like operating by the seat of their pants at night.
Do you expect expert testimony on how long it would have taken Detective Oliver to empty his clip, reload, and fire the rest of the 31 shots? Because this has certainly been an issue around the case, that if it only took like 6 seconds, which I think he claims, or pro-police experts claim, then, you know, it's something he would have done in the heat of panic as he thought he was being fired on or as he thought Joe Guzman was reaching for a gun. But if it took some good number of seconds longer than that, then he may have been expected to be able to see that nobody in the car actually did have a gun, and that would leave him more criminally exposed. Do we expect debate, maybe competing expert witnesses or something like that, Arun, on this point?
I'm not aware either way on whether that's going to happen. I haven't heard of this. I'm not sure if Nicole has either. I mean, I do think that the fact that he is known to have repositioned himself during the shooting, you know, suggests that this took longer than, you know, just a few seconds or whatever, that he was really kind of like clearly doing his best to make sure that he wasn't shot back at. I don't know of anything that's going to sort of discredit that, though.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, anything on that, or I'll ask you one other closing question.
Yeah, I had heard, you know, and I'll, obviously this is all subject to change, but I had heard that the defense was planning to call at least 5 expert witnesses. They've sort of alluded to this in their cross-examination that, you know, a gun expert could be one of them, a tire expert or a vehicle expert to talk about how fast Sean Bell was going when he almost hit, you know, or almost squished Detective Isnora. These are certainly some of the people that they could call if they chose to, but it's unclear whether they feel at this point that there is anything whether they have any responsibility at all to make a case when they claim prosecutors haven't proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt.
This is a trial before one man, Nicole, as you well know, Judge Arthur Cooperman, rather than a jury. The defendants made that choice. How's Judge Cooperman doing? Just give me a quick impression. How is he inserting himself into the proceedings? And does he seem to be leaning one way or the other from any signals he's giving?
Well, some of the examples of how he inserts himself into the proceedings is he is a stickler for detail. And the ways that that's been coming out so far is that the cross streets for this shooting was Liverpool Street and 94th and 95th Avenue. Some of the defense and even some of the prosecutors mistakenly say 94th Street, 95th Street, and each and every time someone makes that little seemingly insignificant mistake, Cooperman is right there correcting them, and it comes up in exhibits, it comes up in, you know, cross-examination. He is just a stickler for detail. As far as whether he has shown any apparent favoritism to one side or the other that would indicate where, you know, he's leaning in terms of the verdict, he's been very, I would say he's been consistently down the middle. When one side objects, he considers whether or not, you know, to overrule it just as often for each side as the other. So as far as trying to get any kind of any sense of where he's going with this case, I think the best evidence we've seen so far is how he responds to some of the prosecution's witnesses, and he is apparently, and it's hard to read his mind, but the only time we've ever seen him seem to lose his patience with any witness so far was when he was speaking to the SUV driver who, you know,
the guy who got in the argument with Sean Bell.
Exactly,
Wahoo.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's a big responsibility for one man. And we'll continue next week to follow the Sean Bell trial. WNYC's Arun Venugopal and Daily News reporter Nicole Bodhi, thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we will go live to Beijing to get the latest on the standoff and crackdown between the Chinese government and people in Tibet. Stay with us.